Good morning, everybody. The digitisation of the 1911 census for Dublin has been a great success. That it is free to all and searchable by individual as well as address ensures that it is an extraordinary resource that facilitates historians in approaching a huge range of subjects and research questions with fresh data and from fresh perspectives. One such subject, which has received minimal attention to date, is the attempt by some Irish suffragists to organise a boycott of the Census of Ireland in 1911. The digitisation of the census returns ensures that we now have a much better idea as to the actions of the suffragists on the night of the 1911 census and the reactions of the authorities. As in Canada, organised female suffragism emerged in Ireland in the 1870s. The first such organisation was founded in Belfast, but perhaps the most important was the Dublin Women's Suffrage Society, founded in 1876, which became the Irish Women's Suffrage and Local Government Association. These suffragist organisations adopted the standard methods of lobby groups. They held meetings, they propagandised, they wrote letters, they organised petitions, they pestered politicians. By the early years of the 20th century, they had made progress. The suffrage issue was by then consistently before the public, but the suffragists had not yet convinced the establishment to legislate for the women's right to vote. At this point, a new phenomenon emerged: militant suffrage groups whose members came to be referred to as suffragettes. In Britain, the most famous of these was the Women's Social and Political Union, which was led by the Pankhursts, Emmeline and her daughters. Between 1905 and 1914, the WSPU was at the forefront of a steadily escalating campaign of militancy. Disruption of political meetings and public protests gave way to the breaking of windows in public buildings, politicians' homes, shops, and then to arson, chemical attacks and bombings. Around 1,000 women and 40 men were jailed in the UK in the years 1905 to 1914 for militant activity in the cause of female suffrage. Initially, the WSPU did not organise in Ireland, and Irish suffragism remained comparatively moderate. But in November 1908, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and Margaret Cousins, along with their feminist husbands Francis Sheehy Skeffington and James Cousins, founded the Irish Women's Franchise League. These are the Sheehy Skeffingtons, and this is Margaret Cousins. The IWFL did not immediately embark upon militant activity. Rather, gradually, a vanguard of committed activists emerged. The first step towards militant action was taken in October 1910, when Sheehy Skeffington and Hilda Webb heckled Augustine Birrell, Chief Secretary of Ireland, at a meeting in Greystones, County Wicklow. In November 1910, six IWFL members, including Margaret Cousins, were imprisoned in England when they participated in protests organised by the WSPU. They broke the windows in Birrell's London home by throwing potatoes through them and were then later arrested when breaking windows on Downing Street. Soon after this, the census of 1911 provided an occasion to suffragists to demonstrate their discontent at home in Ireland. As James Cousins put it, the census was a prime opportunity of throwing metaphorical spanners in official machinery. As with suffrage militancy in general, a boycott of the census was not an idea indigenous to Ireland. The proposal to boycott the census emerged in Britain, where, as in Ireland, the census was fixed for the 2nd of April. This campaign was led by the WSPU and another militant organisation, the Women's Freedom League. Operating under the slogan "No Vote, No Census," these groups announced that as women were not treated as full citizens, their members would not fill out the census form as required by law. It was quite late in March before Irish suffragists began to reveal their final attitudes to the proposed protest. At a public meeting by the IWFL on the 28th of March, 5 days before census night, a Miss Tatlow publicly justified a boycott of the census, arguing that it was, quote, "the government that forced them into their proposed action with regard to the census by failing to keep promises to legislate for female suffrage." When a correspondent to the Irish Times and Freeman's Journal, writing under the name Archibim, complained that, quote, "the census evasion is an attempt to diminish the value of an undertaking of immense importance and social value," and asked, "will the Irish Women's Franchise League explain how they are able to justify such a crime against society as census evasion?" he was met with a volley of responses. Mary F. Earle, a leading member of the IWFL, outlined the thinking that underpinned the boycotters' actions. She wrote, "Women have not votes, and therefore are unable to bring influence of this sort to bear. Hence they are forced to adopt a method less conventional than that used by men. The census is a numbering of the people. We are considered part of the people by the government when it wants to tax us or to count us. We are quite willing to be part of the people as regards the census when we are allowed to be part of the people as regards the parliamentary vote. Earle continued, we quite recognise the importance of the census, but we are sure that the statistics obtained by it will be used as a basis of legislation on matters affecting women by a House of Commons consisting of men only and elected by men only. As laws passed by such a body cannot hardly fail to be unjust to women, we consider we are quite justified in our refusal to supply information. This was not necessarily a position shared by all Irish suffragists. The biographer of Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and the foremost historian of the IWFL, Margaret Ward, has suggested that evading or resisting the census was a matter upon which militants and non-militants agreed. However, some moderate supporters of this female suffrage cause were openly critical of the protest. In the aftermath of the census on the 20th of April, the Dean of Waterford chaired a suffrage meeting in that city, but took the opportunity to state that the census was for the good of the whole community, for the good of the state. Avoiding the census was unworthy of a good citizen. If you might put the matter in a nutshell, it was simply this. Women claimed that they should have their full rights as citizens. Here they had all events, one right as citizens. Carmel Quinlan, the biographer of Hannah and Thomas Haslam, the leading lights in the moderate Irish Women's Suffrage and Local Government Association, has noted a resolution passed by the committee of that organisation at its meeting in March. This stated that the committee would not give any support to the movement for refusing to fill up the census, as such actions would vitiate the returns for the next 10 years. In the days leading up to the census, the press and the authorities in Ireland were curious about the methods that the Irish suffragists committed to resisting the census would adopt. The Freeman's Journal reported that in Dublin, speculation as to the suffragists approach had imported an element of mild excitement into the census taking. This speculation was sustained because, the reporter of the Freeman continued, quote, in refutation of the popular belief that a lady cannot keep a secret, they seem to have guarded their plans successfully. In Britain, the Women's Freedom League and the WSPU planned very public resistance. They organised a series of collective public protests on census night, facilitating suffragists' absence from home or any other residence where they might be counted. In London, for example, the Pankhursts attended a concert at WSPU Hall, followed by a protest march at Trafalgar Square, attended by around 1,000 women, followed by further entertainments laid on at the Scala Theatre, before concluding the night by going to Aldwych Skating Rink between 3 a.m. and 8 a.m. Interestingly, some of the suffragettes of Birmingham spent the night at the Gaelic League Hall there. When a policeman called upon a committee meeting of the IWFL in Dublin on the day before the census and asked if they intended holding a meeting on the following evening, he was informed that they did not, but instead had requisitioned a number of aeroplanes and submarines for the occasion. When interviewed on the day of the census, Marguerite Palmer, Honorary Secretary of the IWFL, told the Irish Times that, quote, she could not divulge any of their plans, but their scheme was entirely different to that employed in England. Instead, she said, Irish suffragists intended to be conspicuous by their absence. So what happened on the 2nd of April? The first point to note is that there were no public gatherings or protests in Ireland. It is not clear why the Irish census evaders decided against public demonstration. The most likely reason is that they would not have been able to muster large numbers. As pointed out already, Irish suffragism was in a period of transition. Suffragist militancy in the country was as yet in its infancy, and the cohort of militant activists was small. Secondly, the organisers of the protest almost certainly hoped that a less demonstrative approach would facilitate the participation of moderates in census evasion. Indeed, a suffragette correspondent to the Freeman's Journal wrote that several of our friends have recently congratulated us on the constitutional and eminently ladylike nature of census resistance. In fact, it is on that very account being very widely adopted in Ireland. Further, gadding about in town at night without male chaperones was not considered ladylike. And in any case, Dublin in 1911 did not offer the range of public spaces that London suffragists had available to them, especially at night. In his letters of some days earlier, Archibim had argued that silent evasion of the census was a pointlessly narrow form of protest, as it cannot be a very successful method of advertisement since, though militant, it is quite unostentatious and incapable of proper estimation of its effects. The publication of Archibim's own letter undermined this argument somewhat, as did the considerable press coverage that the protest received. Archibald was correct to this extent, however. It is extremely difficult, even now, to assess the extent of the boycott because, as David Wilson suggested yesterday, it is very difficult to analyse an absence. Nonetheless, a trawl of the digitised census records for Dublin does reveal certain patterns. At the most fundamental level, a boycott did take place, as a number of Dublin suffragists do not appear to have made returns. There is no return, for instance, for a Marguerite or Margaret Palmer, matching the known biographical detail of the Honorary Secretary of the Irish Women's Franchise League. Neither do returns exist that match the details of the suffragists Marjorie Hasler and Kathleen Houston. Both Hasler and Houston were Dublin-based and were sentenced to prison for militant activity in Dublin in the summer of 1912. It is a reasonable assumption that these women successfully and deliberately evaded the census, although it may never be possible to prove this absolutely. When digitised records for the rest of Ireland are available, it will be possible to rule out their being away in the country for the weekend, but even then the possibility that they were abroad will continue to exist. The digitised census do reveal firm evidence of the attempts of several women to evade the census. One of these is Mary F. Earle. This is her census return. I hope you can see some of it at least, whose letter to the Irish Times we saw earlier. At first glance, Mary Earle appears to have made a return. Here you can see it at her address at 39 Raglan Road, which she gave in her letter to the address which she gave in her letter to the Irish Times. She's the head of household. She's 40. She has two sons and a servant living with her. However, if we look a little more closely, we can see that Mary Earle did not complete this form, but it was filled out by MB or Michael Barry, the census enumerator for this area, and we can see Barry's note filled as a result of inquiries made by the enumerator, Mrs. Earle having refused to give any information. And you can see, if I flick on again, the fact that Mrs. Earle did not make the return is further confirmed by the fact that she... the section over here for the signature of the head of household is blank. Okay. The enumerators of the Census of Ireland had extensive powers to make inquiries about those who did not comply with their obligations under the census. Their ability to wield those powers was enhanced because, unlike in the rest of the United Kingdom, the enumerators in Ireland were policemen. In the case of Dublin, they were members of the Dublin Metropolitan Police. It was the head of household who was primarily responsible for filling the form. And in not making the returns, women such as Mary Earle, who was a head of household, invited prosecution. A boycotting woman who was not the head of household placed the relevant relative in danger of prosecution. In an effort to avoid this second eventuality, it seems that the leadership of the IWFL gathered at least some boycotters in small groups in houses which for various reasons were not enumerated. This tactic was also adopted in Britain, and this is a photograph from Britain. You can see the No Vote, No Census sign up in the house and all the women gathered together asleep on the night of the census. In the memoir of James and Margaret Cousins, written in 1950, James recalled that on census night, Margaret and Lizzie Duffy, their domestic servant, left to stay at a nearby house that had been vacant for some time and therefore not on the enumeration list. James remembered that he was suffering from scarlatina fever at the time, so he was left at home in bed with a form, a pen, an envelope and some disinfectant. He wrote, "When the official hour came, I wrote on the declaration form a note to the effect that I could not give a true enumeration of my household as its female members were absent in protest against being officially classed with children, criminals, lunatics and such like. I added that I had filled the paper while laid up in scarlatina, but had duly disinfected it and the envelope." This is the form that James Cousins filled in for 35 Strand Road. And you can see his actions had acquired some colour with time and telling. There is no sign of the explanatory note and health report that he remembered so vividly in his memoir. Not only that, but you can see that despite his claims to the contrary, James Cousins filled in Lizzie Duffy, the servant's, details into the form. This raises the interesting issue of class and female suffrage. In 1911, the Irish suffragist groups did not demand universal female suffrage, but were willing to accept a limited female franchise linked to property. Despite his claims in 1950 and 1911, James Cousins saw no reason not to enumerate his female servant. Of course, it is possible that Lizzie Duffy wanted to be enumerated. In any case, the DMP enumerator Patrick O'Connell amended the form by crossing out Lizzie Duffy, writing in the detail of Margaret Cousins. She's there as Gertrude. She was sometimes called Greta Gertrude Cousins. and then copying out the details provided on Lizzie Duffy on what society regarded as her proper place at the bottom of the list, before finally noting Mrs. Cousins, who is a suffragette, enumerated from inquiries made. You can see at the bottom of the form again. Here. Hannah Sheehy Skeffington was absent from her home at 11 Grosvenor Place with the purpose of evading the census. In later years, she claimed to have spent the night in Wicklow in a cottage given to her and some other boycotters by Countess Markievicz. She recalled with amusement that we led the police a dance, camping on the hills or in empty houses scattered far and wide. The police reports from the period give no indication that they wasted any energy in attempting to track these women to their hillside refuges. Again, however, the local enumerator did try to ensure that the census was not distorted by Hannah Sheehy Skeffington's absence. Unfortunately and amusingly, James Crozier made a bit of a mess of it. Here you can see the return made by Hannah's husband Francis and Crozier's efforts to amend it, in which Hannah Sheehy Skeffington is forced in between the lines, but she's mistakenly, you probably see a bit better there, she's mistakenly named Emily Sheehy Skeffington. As in the case of James Cousins, Francis Sheehy Skeffington enumerated the female servants. While there is clear evidence of an attempt to evade the census on the part of some members of the IWFL, there were suffragettes who were members or associates of that organisation who do not appear to have made any effort to avoid enumeration. Among the women who feature on the census returns for Dublin without the intervention of the enumerator are Cathy Oldham. She was sometime president of the IWFL. There she is here. Perhaps this is not a surprise, as Oldham was among the more moderate members of the organisation. Also enumerated, however, were Kathleen Emerson, Mabel Purser and Maud Lloyd, all of whom would go to prison because of militant action carried out under the IWFL banner in either 1912 or 1913. This may indicate that these women were not yet radicalised in April 1911, or that they disagreed with the census boycott as a form of protest. Maud Lloyd filled in the form herself as a head of household. Perhaps she feared prosecution. In the cases of Emerson, who was she's third in the list here, she was a recently widowed woman who had returned to live with her parents. You can see she's been filled in by her father. And Mabel Purser, this is her return. She's Lucy Mabel Purser. Again, she's filled in by her husband. So perhaps they were enumerated against their will by their father and husband, respectively. In his work on 19th century censuses, as a source for the study of female occupations in Britain, Edward Higgs has illustrated the extent to which men dominated the census-taking process. Men framed the questions, acted as enumerators, processed the information, and perhaps most importantly in this context, men were expected to act as head of household and fill out the form. Even if Purser's husband or Emerson's father was sympathetic to their suffragist views, it is possible that Purser and Emerson acquiesced in their enumeration because they did not want to expose their male relatives to legal sanction. Some of those who were reluctant to boycott the census found other ways to use it as a vehicle of protest. This is the census return of Tom Kettle and his wife Mary Sheehy Kettle. Mary was Hannah Sheehy Skeffington's sister. She regularly appeared on suffragist platforms, and on 6th of April, she spoke at a meeting at Kingstown, now Dunleary, as Dermot said, which was chaired by Mary Earle and addressed by Emmeline Pankhurst. At the meeting, Mary Kettle reportedly said that they had never got anything in Ireland from a hostile government except by militant methods. Yet at first glance, the Kettle census form appears to have been filled out without fuss. A closer examination, however, reveals a modest, if telling, alteration to the form. Tom Kettle, having signed the form, amended this section from signature of the head of household to signature of the heads of the family. This is the return of the Tickle family of 11 Sandford Road, Ranelagh. Mrs. Adeline Tickle appeared on the platform when Emmeline Pankhurst spoke at the Ancient Concert Rooms in Dublin City Centre, also on the 6th of April, when Pankhurst again justified the census protest. As you can see, Adeline Tickle did not boycott the census, but she did make her mark. The last column on the census form provided a space where the head of household was expected to note those in the home who were either deaf and dumb, dumb only, blind, imbecile or idiot, or lunatic. The idea was that the head of household would, quote, write the respective infirmities opposite the name of the afflicted person. In this case, you can see Mrs. Tickle is enumerated as being voteless. You can see it down. Members of the Quaker community tended to disproportionately support female enfranchisement. And here is the return of two Quaker sisters, Josephine and Emily Webb. We can see they filled in the infirmity column with unenfranchised. And finally, this is the return of 21 Annesley Park, the residence of Ellen Jane Bell and her cousin Maud Joint, a suffragist activist. And here you can see again they went for the unenfranchised version. So what conclusions can we draw as to the impact of the suffragist boycott of the census of Ireland in 1911? It seems quite clear that the numbers who succeeded in evading enumeration in Ireland were very small indeed. Hannah Sheehy Skeffington recorded in her memoir that our numbers abstaining did not greatly throw out the census figures. At the time, the government was confident this was the case. In Britain, where evasion was more widespread, the president of the local government board could report to Parliament that the number of successful evaders was, quote, altogether negligible. The protest emphasised the divisions within Irish suffragism. Rather than uniting suffragists, as Ward has suggested, it marked a further stage on the road towards full-scale militant activity in Ireland. Although the availability of the census returns reveals that supporters of female suffragism in Ireland utilised the census to protest in a variety of ways beyond the simplest and most extreme form of protest, the boycott. Although numbers involved were small, the suffragists did succeed in drawing a good deal of attention to their cause through the census protest. The government decided not to prosecute those heads of households who had failed to record the details of suffragist protesters. Till after, the president of the local government board in Britain informed Parliament that in the hour of success, mercy and magnanimity should be shown. And this approach was mirrored by the Irish authorities. A series of court cases, fines and perhaps even imprisonments with attendant publicity would have been welcomed by the militant suffragists, but evidently not by the authorities. The impression that militant suffragism in Ireland was a middle-class pursuit is borne out by the census campaign. All the evidence of the census protest that I have found for Dublin appear in returns from middle-class areas such as Rathgar and Rathmines. While the willingness in the homes of suffragists to enumerate female servants is also suggestive. Finally, the census boycott has the potential for one lingering effect which will concern genealogists more than historians. There may be those out there whose ability to uncover vital information about their female ancestors is permanently circumscribed because these women do not appear in the census of Ireland of 1911. Thank you.